From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. The life of Paul Robeson on today's Fresh Air. My guest Martin Baumel-Duberman sued the FBI to get access to their files on Robeson to research his new biography. Also today, I speak with poet Ann Waldman, a key figure in the wave of poets who followed the beat writers in the 60s. Susanna McCorkle sings a couple of Cole Porter songs, and critic Ken Tucker reviews Point Blank, a film directed by John Boorman, first released back in 1967. Unlike many films from its era, Ken says this one stands the test of time, and it's now on home video. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Robeson, the son of an ex-slave, became an all-American athlete and a star of the stage, screen, and concert hall. But Robeson never interpreted his success as a sign that discrimination against blacks was easing. Robeson's biographer writes, from 1940 to 1960, Robeson evolved fully from an artist with a conscience to an artist committed to political action. The more white America failed in the post-World War II years to stand up for the rights of people of color, the more Robeson grew into a militant spokesman for the world's oppressed. Robeson's stand endeared him to those who shared his politics, but cost him dearly with the multitude of mainstream Americans who had once been among his admirers. Robeson's support of Soviet communism made him the subject of suspicion in America. He was kept under surveillance by the FBI, and the State Department denied him a passport during the McCarthy era. He was blacklisted in America. Robeson died in 1976 after more than a decade of broken mental and physical health and two suicide attempts. The author of the new biography of Paul Robeson is my guest, Martin Baumel-Duberman. Duberman is a historian, playwright, a gay rights activist, and a distinguished professor of history at the City University of New York. Duberman was chosen by Paul Robeson's son to write his father's biography. I asked how that came about.
The way it's told to me, both by Paul and by my agent, who was then his as well, Francis Golden, was that they had been working together trying to find an appropriate biographer, and Paul had not come up with a choice that pleased him. And then one day when he was in Fran's office, he happened to see my books on the shelf and started to browse and liked what he was reading and took some of them home and said to Fran, you know, I think we've found him. And he never specified to me precisely what qualities he found in my writing that he thought were appropriate or perhaps even in my life. But we met soon after that, and within a half hour, we had concluded. I told him that what I would require, I said I was thrilled at being invited to do the book, that I'd always admired Paul Robeson, and I was also deeply flattered because I'm white. He was prepared to offer me exclusive access to the archives, which had been closed previously to all professional scholars. And I told him one more thing that I would require would be a formal legal agreement that he gave up all control over whatever it was that I finally decided to put into the book. And he agreed to that, and so we were off.
I think a lot of people were surprised that Paul Robeson Jr. chose a white historian to write the biography of his father. Where do you stand on that? Do you think that it matters if a person's white or black, if they're writing black history or the biography of a black figure?
I think it all hinges on... I mean, the question is really a question, can anybody who does not exactly duplicate another person's life successfully write about them. That would mean, can a man write about a woman? Can an older person write about a younger person? Can a straight person write about a gay person, et cetera? I think the points of identification that make for success are very individual. Because of certain experience of my own, I think, at least in comparison with other professional historians, I have some unusual qualifications for taking on the biography. For example, I've been active in left politics. I've had a career in the theater, both mostly as a playwright, but to some minor extent as an actor. And beyond all of that, I think, I too have been, in a way, a spy in the culture, just as Robeson was, though on a different level. I mean, I'm a gay man who has always, quote, passed in straight society. I've never had any trouble, you know, getting good jobs, getting ahead in my career and so forth. And yet I always felt like I was an outsider who had been let inside. And I think something of that same psychological mechanism was operating in Robeson. I mean, he mm-hmm. was a black man who had been allowed in, but always knew that he never entirely belonged and always was evaluating the culture even while he was participating in it.
One of the things you did when you were researching the book was to file under the Freedom of Information Act to get Robeson's FBI files, and eventually you sued the FBI. Why did you sue them?
I sued them because under Reagan, FOIA is a joke. No scholar, regardless of his or her subject, can in fact get much material under FOIA any longer. And yet I felt it was urgent to get that material because rumors have been floating around for many years that various agencies of our government, but especially the FBI, were complicitous in the decline of Robeson's health, as of course they were complicitous in the decline of his public reputation. When I originally applied under FOIA, I was sent some material for the early 1940s, but basically I was sent large box after large box of essentially inked out pages. And I realized the only hope of getting what could be crucial data was to sue. And I found a good radical lawyer, Ed Greer in Boston, who has a lot of experience with FOIA, and so we went to court. It took, we were in court about 3 years, at a cost of something like $20,000. And by that point, we were nearing the completion of the manuscript. And Ed said to me, look, the FBI has a battery of lawyers. They can fight this through all kinds of appeals. Your book's nearly done. Even if we win at the final level of appeal, you'll get the information too late to use in the book. And so Ed suggested a formal negotiation. In fact, I think the FBI suggested it, and we finally agreed to it. In other words, they let me have brief descriptions of something like 15 or 20 key documents. At least they said they were key. God knows what they weren't giving me to choose from. And on the basis of those brief descriptions, I made my choices. I think I got like 8 or 10. They were almost all disappointing. The brief descriptions were inflations, in fact, of the actual contents of the documents. So it ended up being very disappointing. Probably the most disastrous thing that happened as a result of the litigation was that one day one of the FBI lawyers with a real smirk on his face said to Ed Greer, isn't it funny, he said, we started with, and here I forget the exact numbers, I think, We started with 105 or 6 volumes of files on Robeson's, and now, for some strange reason, 56 of them have disappeared. Ha ha. In other words, if there was damaging material in the FBI files, that material, as a result of my lawsuit, alas, has now been destroyed. So we may never know the full truth about the government's involvement in Robeson's physical decline.
Can you sum up for us what you did learn about the FBI surveillance of Robeson and any possible harassment?
Well, there's no doubt, the material is voluminous, that the FBI and other agencies harassed Robeson relentlessly. They followed him, a New York agent followed him on what may well have been a near daily basis. His mail was opened, his phone was tapped, not his own phone, but his conversations with others. I think the extent and the duration of this harassment does go some way to explaining Robeson's emotional breakdown. As one of his psychiatrists said to me, what's surprising is not that Robeson eventually broke down, but that Robeson did not break down earlier as a result of this kind of intense scrutiny and harassment.
Several reviewers of your biography of Paul Robeson have mentioned that they thought that you didn't spend enough time talking about Robeson's reaction to the Stalinist revelations, the revelations about the purges. Robeson had, although he was never a member of the Communist Party in America, he was very sympathetic to the Soviet Revolution and visited the Soviet Union often and sympathized with communism. What's your response? And how much did you find out about his response to the Soviet purges?
Mm-hmm. Well, the major problem in the biography in general, but specifically in terms of this question, is that Robeson left very few personal traces, meaning he kept no diary, except for very few shorthand notes once in a while. And throughout his life, he wrote very few letters. It's as if he deliberately decided he did not wish to be tracked, either then or retrospectively. So it's been very hard to reconstruct anything about his inner life. And on an issue like Stalin's crimes, Paul Robeson Jr. said to me he was in the room when his father read the New York Times, which carried Khrushchev's speech, and his father put the newspaper down after reading it and never said one word, either at the time or ever after. And other of Robeson's intimate friends, who I've interviewed in depth, have confirmed it. He never spoke, even in private, in other words, even to his intimates. The way I've interpreted that silence is that, his great heart was almost certainly, profoundly disturbed and unhappy at those revelations, but he did not wish himself to become an obstacle to socialism. He hoped that the Soviet experiment would eventually right itself, and that the crimes of a single leader, Joseph Stalin, did not destroy the potential of that experiment. So he chose silence. He did not wish to feed the propaganda mill. He did not wish to lend any support to the right-wing bigots who currently controlled, that is, in the 1950s, the American government.
Do you think too much attention is being paid to his response to Stalinism?
Absolutely. I think, in a way, it's shocking the way some of the white reviewers, never the black ones, are getting fixated on this single issue. And I think the reason is they rather continue Cold War rhetoric and continue to red bait Robeson, then deal with the totality of his life, then deal, for example, with his deep compassion for the oppressed, his militant insistence on the rights of his own people for full freedom, and his daring to question whether or not it might not be the greed and the competitive zeal engendered by the capitalist ethic which accounts for the needless amount of suffering everywhere in the world.
I want to talk with you more about Paul Robeson's life, but first we're going to take a short break. And my guest is Martin Baumel-Duberman, who's just written a biography of Paul Robeson. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is historian, biographer, playwright, and gay activist Martin Baumel-Duberman. He was chosen by Paul Robeson Jr. to write a biography of his father. The biography of Paul Robeson has just been published by Knopf. Duberman is a professor of history at the City University of New York. Did you feel a tension in any of his performances of giving his best performance possible, but also being pulled into playing certain stereotypic roles?
I think all of his roles were stereotypes. I think, nonetheless, he broke through the stereotypes in many of his performances simply because of the charisma and the mm-hmm. dignity of the personality. So that even if he was playing some absurdist version of an African chief, just the strength and integrity of the personality shone through on the screen.
You say that he retired from movies because he thought the situation with stereotyping was hopeless, and he felt that the only solution to big-budget stereotyping was for the federal government to create standards of honest treatment and for filmmakers to make low-budget films that wouldn't be reliant on the South for profits. What do you think have liked to stay in movies and in a performing career if it weren't for stereotyping? Or do you think he was more interested in a kind of more politically oriented career anyways?
I think he would have hoped not to be forced to make that choice. I mean, after all, he quit movies in 1942, and it's only roughly a year and a half later that he performs Othello on Broadway. Mm-hmm. I think he would have been pleased if additional roles were offered to him. I mean, that is roles that represented something other than the stereotype. I think he would have been happy to perform them. He just wasn't offered those roles.
An interesting contradiction that I thought was brought up in your book was how Robeson really didn't like jazz, especially in the 20s and 30s, though he came to enjoy it more later mm-hmm. on. And he said if you took Ellington's rhythms and compared it to real African music, that Ellington's rhythms sounded childish. What I thought was the contradiction was that in his own concert career, the spirituals he sang had such a kind of European concert type of flavor to them.
Well, that's the exact criticism in his own day that was leveled by Zora Neale Hurston. She felt that Robeson did represent the European tradition. She thought he did better in that tradition than anybody else. But she felt that the spirituals and the work songs were folk material and needed to be sung and perhaps not even performed, but sung by a collective group rather than by a soloist. So yes, that criticism was leveled in Robeson's own day. On the other hand, you know, the unique warmth and vibrance of that voice, the deep emotionality of the voice, I think do create and convey the essential strength and poignancy of that music.
Robeson's story, the way you tell it, is really both tragedy and triumph. He had so many remarkable accomplishments, yet he was shut out of so much. He was harassed. He was condemned. He wasn't allowed to perform where he wanted to. So it's really this double-edged story.
Very much so. Yeah. Yeah, I think one of the saddest aspects of it is that he was even shut out by the black establishment. In those years, as Bayard Rustin said to me, I mean, the black leadership felt, realistically or not, that it was far more beholden to the white powers that be for favors. And so once Robeson got doubly labeled, that is, black and red, the black establishment felt that it could it would only jeopardize its own standing if it continued to accept or associate with Robeson. But as Bayard Rustin also said to me, that doesn't mean that what the black leadership said publicly about Robeson, and they did troop to the microphones in order to denounce him, was the same as what they felt privately about him. They certainly recognized, at the very least, that Robeson, through his militant insistence on full freedom, made their more moderate partial demands more palatable to the white powers that be.
You seem to be a historian who, over the years, has really struggled with the value of history and its relevance to the present. And I think there have been periods of your career as a historian where you've really been thrown into a crisis over the relevance of history. And I was wondering what first precipitated that crisis.
Oh, that's a tough one. I mean, to the extent I understand my own, you know, inner process, I think I wanted history to problem solve. I was myself getting increasingly active in the 60s, politically active, and I wanted some, you know, relevant information from the past that would help me and others to come up with solutions for some of the issues that were bothering us in the present. I finally concluded that in that kind of, you know, specific, concrete way, the past could never offer anything like blueprints or solutions. What it could offer is, you know, a roughly analogous situation in which people in the past have tried to cope with a roughly analogous problem. So after going through a rather stormy period in which I doubted that history was worth anything, I've since come back to believe that it's worth quite a bit.
You have a collection of your essays on history, and one of them is about your realization that although you had spent so much time studying history, you knew very, very little about your own family history, and that your father, who was from the Soviet Union, had really never told you much about anything about life in the Soviet Union. Why did that start to affect you, the absence of a personal family history?
It was just a general sense I had that somehow to study history professionally was a way of compensating for my own lack of personal memory. I'm not even sure that I'm right in that. I may have invented that connection, but at the time I felt it strongly. I don't understand why it is that I have such a bad memory myself as an individual. I once described it as having a kind of large eraser hanging down my back, and as I took steps forward, the eraser automatically made all my footsteps disappear.
It seems that a turning point for you is when you started writing gay history, that all your questions about the relevance of history were perhaps answered in part when you started writing about gay history, because it was such a personally significant subject for you.
Only in part. Once again, I mean, when historians began, it's only about 15 years ago, to try to discover a gay and lesbian past, I think the general hope was that if we looked back, we would find people who were more or less replicas of ourselves. That has turned out not to be the case, and this is, you know, an elaborate conclusion, which I'll try not to go into in any detail here, but like everything else about human nature, homosexuality took on very different shapes and forms in the past than it does today. And so once again, we can't find, you know, any exact replicas or duplications of ourselves.
But on the other hand, you're learning something about the truth of the gay and lesbian past. I think so many stereotypes and myths are based on this false sense of history.
Yeah, I think what we learn is something more general. What we learn, if we study people in the past who were different, and this means gender nonconformists of all kinds, they don't have to specifically have a gay sexual orientation, but if we study people who were different, we learn something about, you know, how they coped with the forces of oppression that were brought to bear on them. And indeed, those forces have always been brought to bear on nonconformists in the United States, because we are such a deeply conformist country. And in learning about those strategies and in learning about the determination of people in the past to, you know, insist that they be treated respectfully, I think we learn a lot about ourselves and our own resources for coping in the present.
You have published excerpts of your own journal, which is a kind of personal history, and you talk a lot about the pressure to conform, and all the therapy that you are in, with doctors telling you that you should really change your ways, that it was sick to be a homosexual. Were there like particular therapy plans that were prescribed for you to convert?
Ah, you want to dredge up those terrible years. Okay. I mean, in a way, you could say I wasn't subjected, you know, to the worst of those therapies. I mean, there was a period not so long ago, alas, in which the behaviorists used to place their gay male patients on electric grids and then flash pictures of naked men on the wall and shock the patient. I, as I say, was not subjected to that kind of barbarity. But I was told, you know, year after year in both individual and group therapy, that I was suffering from a basic character disorder, that I was deeply disturbed, that I had no chance for a happy, satisfying life unless I devoted myself to conversion, to becoming a bona fide heterosexual. And indeed, sad to relate, I so devoted myself for many years. Because when you grew up gay in the 40s and the 50s, the homophobia was so overwhelming and so intense that almost inevitably you did internalize it. You did come to think just as badly of yourself as the society wanted you to. And therefore you followed, you know, the social cues, and you presented yourself for therapy, and you tried to make yourself over into a more acceptable kind of human being. The therapist that I was with during most of the 60s announced that I was the only homosexual that he had never cured. And that was because, as he put it, I was the single most defiant personality he had ever met. To which I can only say in retrospect, thank God for my defiance.
Does that stuff stick with you even when you start to realize this is ridiculous? Did the result of those attempts to convert you stay with you?
Absolutely. I mean, I think there'll always be a residue within me of, you know, self-contempt. I may have gotten off better than most of my generation. I mean, after all, there are very few people of my generation, that is men over or women over the age of 45, who ever come out. I mean, they don't feel entitled still to that kind of standing up for themselves. I mean, declaring the rightness of their lives. And that's because, you know, they too ingested this homophobia with their pablum. You don't get rid of those, you know, formative impressions about yourself just by wanting to. Yeah, I think the whole generation is deeply scarred, certainly myself included.
You've written so many different kinds of history, from plays to straightforward history to essays on the writing of history to personal biography, personal autobiography to biography of others. Your latest book is the Paul Robeson book. You had gone through a crisis earlier in your career about the relevance of history to the present. Has writing the biography of Paul Robeson affected you in terms of thinking about the relevance of history and the relevance of biography?
Well, in the Robeson book, I've returned to a very traditional format. I'm not attempting any of the fancy interventions and the subjective musings which I did attempt in one of my books, A History of Black Mountain College. I think just being put in touch with Robeson's life in detail, I mean, it's the texture of the detail that I think is so informative. I don't know, one has to use an old-fashioned word, at least I do. I mean, I think it's inspiring to learn about a life like Robeson's, in which he gave up privilege. He was sitting in the lap of luxury. He was on top of the world in the 1930s. He gave it up, fully recognizing what the consequences were likely to be, in order to speak out and speak out militantly in defense of those who had been less privileged and were perhaps less gifted than he. I think that's a noble and an inspiring story, and yes, does make me think that history, once again, has some relevance.
I want to thank you so much for talking with us. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
My guest has been Martin Baumel-Duberman, and his new biography of Paul Robeson has just been published by Knopf. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, our guest will be feminist author Susan Brownmiller. Her new novel, Waverly Place, is based on the story of Hedda Nussbaum, Joel Steinberg, and the death of their adopted daughter, Lisa Steinberg. The family lived near Brownmiller's Greenwich Village apartment. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Anne Waldman is known not only for the poems she writes, but for her work introducing other poets. She used to run the St. Mark's Poetry Project in New York, and in 1975 with Allen Ginsberg, she co-founded the writing program at the Naropa Institute in Colorado. Coming up, Anne Waldman reads and talks about her poems. Also, singer Susanna McCorkle performs a few Cole Porter songs, and critic Ken Tucker reviews Point Blank, a 1967 film directed by John Borman that's just been released on videocassette. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green. Some 20,000 feet over the Pacific Ocean today, a gaping hole ripped open in the right side of a United Airlines jumbo jet. There were 354 passengers on board the Boeing 747. Most made it back to safety in Honolulu after the plane made an emergency landing. But United officials report 9 people are missing. They're presumed to have been sucked out of the aircraft as it depressurized. Passenger Diane Garber describes what happened.
All the light panels and the oxygen, everything came tumbling down on us. My husband must have hit his hand on the flying debris, broke his hand, and we just thought we were dying. By the time we looked over, there were about 6 seats against the window that were gone, and all the passengers were gone out of the plane.
Of those who survived the fuselage breakdown, at least 10 have been reported injured. The Boeing company, which built the plane, and Pratt & Whitney, which makes the jet's engines, have dispatched accident teams to Hawaii to help NTSB investigators find out what happened. The FBI says it's unlikely that foul play is to blame. The Bush administration has apparently chosen a new assistant attorney general for civil rights. He is William Lucas, a former black Democrat turned Republican. The appointment is an apparent signal that the Bush administration wants to modify Reagan administration policies. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
Lucas is a black former FBI agent, former policeman, and Democrat turned Republican. As a Democrat, Lucas was elected sheriff and county executive in Wayne County, Michigan. He won praise in those jobs for his executive ability, but was reportedly frustrated at his inability to move up to higher elected positions. Wooed by the Republican Party, he switched to the GOP and ran unsuccessfully for governor. Civil rights leaders were less than overwhelmed by the Lucas nomination. Said one, "It's nice they picked a minority, but what we've gotten so far from the Bush administration is all symbols and no substance." Civil rights advocates were particularly troubled by Lucas's lack of civil rights experience. Lucas's principal experience is in law enforcement. With the exception of a brief period when he served in the Justice Department doing civil rights work just out of law school, the 61-year-old Lucas has had no experience in this extremely complex field of law. Said one civil rights advocate, "With all the people available who do have the experience, the choice of Bill Lucas just falls short." I'm Nina Totenberg in Washington.
The courier who shuttled between Oliver North and the Nicaraguan Contras today told the court that's trying North that he continued to provide tactical aid to the rebels even after Congress had banned it. Rob Owen said that North had once suggested that the Contras mount a suicide air raid on the Managua airport. Owen said that he met with North 80 to 100 times in 1983 and 84. That contradicts North's testimony to Congress, in which he said that he met Owen only a couple of times. Loans will be harder to come by now that the Federal Reserve has raised the rate it charges banks for infusions of cash. Today, the discount rate went up 0.5%. Now at 7%, it's at its highest level in 3 years. Economist Richard Silla of North Carolina State University says bank customers will feel the effects right away.
They're going to find that the banks are a little fussier. There's less credit to pass out. And I've talked to some businessmen. They're already saying it's not that you can't get a loan, but you have to shop around much harder for it. And for a consumer, I think consumer loans, automobile loans, for example, are probably going to rise somewhat. Pretty soon, I think we'll see upward pressure on mortgage interest rates. So those two big things, housing and automobile loans, are going to cost consumers more in the months ahead.
The Federal Reserve's move ends a week in which major banks raised the prime lending rate, and the Labor Department reported the highest level of inflation on the retail level in 2 years. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost nearly 44 points today to close at 2245.54. Declines outpaced advancers 5-1. You're listening to National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Singer Susanna McCorkle is one of the most gifted interpreters of American popular song. Her recordings have celebrated the work of composers like Yip Harburg, Johnny Mercer, and Harry Warren. Susanna is performing in Philadelphia now as part of the American Music Theater Festival. And for us, she has some favorite songs by Cole Porter.
Some people came up to me after this song when I sang it in New Jersey and said, you know, that has an anti-New Jersey reference in it. I said, I'm terribly sorry, really. I try not to offend anyone. And I thought about it, and sure enough, it does. It's anti-New Jersey.
Is it an earthquake or simply a shock? Is it the good turtle soup or merely the mock? Is it a cocktail, this feeling of joy? Or is what I feel the real McCoy? Is it for all time or simply a lark? Is it the Lido I see or only Asbury Park? Is it a fancy not worth thinking of? Or is it a long last love? Will it be tender and sweet or merely massage? Is it a brainstorm in one of its quirks? Or is it the best, the crest, the works? Is it rescue or is it to wreck? Is it an ache in the heart? Just a pain in the neck? Is it the ivy you touch with a glove? Or is it a long last love? Should I say thumbs down and give it a shove? Or is it a long
that one's about maybe falling in love and wondering and worrying and asking yourself some questions so you won't get in trouble again. This one is about somebody who did get in trouble. A bittersweet song about a romance that went bad but was sure worth it while it lasted.
As Dorothy Parker once said to her boyfriend, fare thee well. As Columbus announced when he found he was bounced, it was swell, Isabel, swell. As Abelard said to Eloise, don't forget to drop a line to me, please. As Juliet cried in her Romeo's ear, Romeo, why not face the fact? My dear, it was just one of those things, just one of those crazy flings, one of those bells that now and then rings, just one of those things. It was just one of those nights, just one of those those fabulous flights, a trip to the moon on gossamer wings, just one of those things. If we'd thought of it to the end of it when we started painting the town, we'd have been aware that our love affair was too hot not to cool down. So goodbye, dear.
Susanna McCorkle was joined by Ben Aronoff on piano and Chip Jackson on bass. Her new recording, No More Blues, will be released next month on Concord Records. This is Fresh Air. For decades, writers from around the country have come to New York's Greenwich Village to live in a community of artists. Anne Waldman didn't have to travel far. She grew up in Greenwich Village. And in the 1960s, she became a key figure in New York's poetry scene. From 1968 to 77, she ran the influential St. Mark's Poetry Project, a series of readings at a church in Manhattan's Lower East Side. Writer Aram Saroyan once wrote, "Of all the poets of my generation, none has done more than Anne Waldman to bring poetry before the public at large." In 1975, Waldman and Allen Ginsberg co-founded the writing program at the Naropa Institute for Buddhist Studies in Colorado, which she still directs. She's also developed a following for her own performance poetry. She told me how she got started writing poems.
I think it came out of, you know, reading of poetry, which my mother was much more of a poetry reader. My father was more of a prose reader. And reading aloud. And I've found some things in old notebooks and journals from, you know, the age of 9 and 10 and 11. I remember when I started sending poems out to the Evergreen Review and the Village Voice when I was in high school, or probably even earlier than that. And it seemed very organic, somehow, the idea of it. And I had a typewriter at quite an early age, an old Olivetti. So I sort of enjoyed the way one would work on the page, the spacing and, you know, playing with that kind of thing.
Growing up in Greenwich Village, you probably saw a lot of poets around you when you were young. Did you have an idealized image of what the poet's life would be?
I don't know about idealized. Certainly there's some romantic quality there, and I remember seeing Gregory Corso, who seemed typical of the poet maudit, you know, the kind of damned or lost poet. I heard Robert Lowell read at an early age at NYU. There was something about the quality of bearing, you know, bearing your soul in a way, but in a formalized situation, you know, working with form, actually taking the chaos and making it somehow ordered and more refined so that it wasn't simply getting up and being indulgent about your emotional state of mind.
You've said that your poetry has been as influenced by the radio and the telephone as by other poets, and I'd like you to explain that.
Well, I think as a child there was some, you know, that wonderful experience of being in bed at night and playing with a radio, flipping the dial around, and having that, you know, all those different voices and music come in. And a lot of the work I'm doing comes out of a sort of collage technique, you know, where you're putting different kinds of phrasings together and different voices. Often it's something I might overhear, you know, on the street. Or I was talking about in some of the more musical work, this phrase comes into my head, such as skin, meat, bones. And then I, you know, explore that as a kind of, voice, and where it crops up in different ways, and almost a free association. I think that, you know, that quality of range and vocabulary and music that you get from the radio, as well as, you know, the speaking voice. And Frank O'Hara once said something about the, you know, poem being as direct as a phone call, you know, that the communication can be that direct, and that immediate and energetic.
Would you read us just a few lines of Skin, Meat, Bones?
Certainly. And this actually, I woke up out of a dream, and I'd heard these notes. I actually woke to the notes, hearing the word skin, high range, meat, and bones. And I thought, this is it. I've discovered the, you know, meaning of life. It's all just skin, meat, and bones. And, you know, it seemed like the perfect haiku. And then, of course, later I realized it didn't quite do it all. So the poem became a kind of, you know, meditation using those notes as a refrain. And there's a lot of play and wordplay, especially with the bones. So I'll read a little section here. I've come to tell you of the things dear to me and what I've discovered of the skin, meat, bones. Your body waking up so sweet to me, skin. Dawn light its green skin. I'm in hungry repose. Meat, it's getting close to motion. Oh, skeleton bone. You might stretch it now. Skin, so warm flesh and lasting a while. Bone, clock like a bone creaking. Memory like a bone creaking. Little laughter lines around the eyes. Skin, and how the mouth's redder than the rest. Meat, or nipples off purple ribcage of bones. It's morning anywhere. Oh, sitting and lying around in my weary tinsel skin. Gotta get up and walk around in my cumbersome skin. Put on lightweight cotton skin and shuffling skin slippers. The light's going to make it raw skin or vulnerable meat or hard bones.
What were you listening to that had the skin, meat, bones thing in it?
I don't know.
Because you said you woke up hearing it, and I wasn't sure if you heard it in your mind or if you heard it on TV.
Yes, that's what I was saying. I heard it in my mind.
Does this happen to you a lot, that you wake up with words going through your mind?
Well, sometimes. Sometimes it's a more formal kind of narrative thing that comes out of a dream.
How did you start writing this more performance-oriented poetry?
I think at one point the poems were getting longer, and it was either Kenneth Koch or Allen Ginsberg. Actually, both of them were very encouraging after a particular reading. And I remember Kenneth saying, I like your vibrato, you know, extended and have the attitude of an opera singer. And of course, Alan, who writes long, often song-like, Whitman-esque pieces, was, you know, encouraging as well.
You really need a performer's confidence to pull it off. A lot of poets read their poems in quiet voices and really don't think of themselves as performers. Mm-hmm. But when you're reading in the way you are, it's really more of a theatrical type of thing. Did you have the courage at the beginning when you started doing it?
Well, I think in the very beginning I was extraordinarily nervous, and the traditional way to read seemed to be, you know, seated. And I remember looking into my page, you know, with my head somewhat bowed, and the voice was really, I could feel it on some level, very much in there and having a real power. And yet, because of the perhaps lack of confidence or, you know, some kind of fear and that, you know, why should I be putting my words out here in this way? You know, I was holding back. And I always felt there was a bigger voice inside in the beginning that I just needed to expand more. And then when I began, you know, standing up, it made a tremendous difference.
You and Allen Ginsberg co-founded a poetry and writing program at the Naropa Institute for Buddhist Studies in Colorado. And I was wondering if you were a student of the teacher there yourself, or if you're a Buddhist.
I feel like I'm only a Buddhist when I'm actually practicing Buddhism.
Uh-huh.
And much the same as, you know, one's a poet as much as one is writing it. And yes, I consider myself a practicing Buddhist in that it's a kind of, almost view of things that's permeated my whole outlook. But I feel I had that anyway. You know, I had a sort of sense of the maybe the illusory quality of one's existence, and a kind of interest in taking things apart, and actually, feeling. I remember feeling at a very early age, I was just this, bundle of tendencies, a conglomeration of tendencies, that my being was not so solid. And I think I've tended to somewhat explore that in the poetry as well, and that, for example, in the makeup of it on Empty Space, actually putting everything into emptiness and then kind of taking it apart as the poem goes on, there's a kind of a dismantling quality, and actually thinking of poems as ritual enactments.
Do you feel that you and your poet friends have had to work hard at all to gain credibility from the poetry establishment?
Well, I think there's I don't know if one worked hard for that reason. I think we're just, working hard, and there's, quite a bit of sympathy. And wherever I travel, I feel like I have many poet friends who are, considered more in the academic world. I think there's a new generation, certainly my generation, which is now out there, teaching and traveling around and being acknowledged through their publishing and their work. And I think there is credibility. I've certainly had no difficulty with that.
Anne Waldman's recent books include Blue Mosque, published by United Artists, and Skin, Meat, Bones, published by Coffee House Press. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is joining us from Washington, D.C., with a look at what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Noah.
Hi, dear.
What are you covering?
Well, there's quite a bit of scrambling on Capitol Hill today and in Tokyo also, as the Bush administration gets set for a fight on the floor of the Senate next week, most likely to be quite a partisan struggle about the nomination of John Tower to be Secretary of Defense. Also, a different view put forth on the question of whether Iran is now turning away from the West again. The answer is no, they can't afford to. Iran faces $500 billion worth of war reconstruction. And we'll talk with Kenneth Frizzell, a North Carolina composer, about his work called Blue Ridge Airs for piano, and about the sound, played on piano, of an indigo bunting.
Thanks, Noah. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. British director John Borman's film, Point Blank, has just been released on home video more than 20 years after its premiere. The film was a huge hit in Europe back when it first came out and established Borman's reputation there. But critic Ken Tucker says that despite the film's success abroad, it was not well received here in the United States.
Point Blank was the great overlooked film of 1967. It came out the same year as Arthur Penn's Bonnie and Clyde, and that innovative movie caused a pop culture sensation, and deservedly so. But Point Blank, a commercial bomb, is pretty amazing. It's one of the most abstract genre films ever made, and unlike a lot of 60s experiments, it more than stands the test of time on video cassette. Point Blank stars a very lean, almost supernaturally mean Lee Marvin as Walker, a tough hood who's been double-crossed by his partner in crime, played by John Vernon. The story is based on a tough guy novel written by Donald Westlake. Marvin and Vernon pull a big heist, but then Vernon shoots Lee Marvin and takes not only the money, but also Marvin's wife. This happens in the opening moments of Point Blank, and Lee Marvin spends the rest of the movie getting his revenge. Everything about this movie is brutally succinct. The images are quick, the dialogue is curt, purposely flat. There's a chilling menace conveyed by keeping things short and clipped. In this scene, Marvin is trying to locate his wife by questioning his sultry sister-in-law, played by Angie Dickinson.
I heard you're running with Race.
Well, you heard it wrong.
Does he want you?
Sure he does.
do you want him?
He makes my flesh crawl.
I want him. Why don't you want him?
I don't want any of them, Walker. I was going with a guy who owned a club, jazz club.
Yeah, the movie house.
Our organization wanted to become his partner. And he killed him. No, I loved him.
Why?
Hey, gotta make a living.
John Borman went on to make hits like Deliverance and Hope and Glory. He also made wildly imaginative bombs like Zardoz and The Exorcist II, The Heretic, which, even though I know you'll never believe me, is actually very entertaining. Rent it sometime. But in Point Blank, Borman combined the wild and the commercial aspects of his filmmaking in a way he's never done since. He gives us a mystery story we can follow, but like a poet, he gives this work a unifying image, which in this case is glass. He keeps shooting Lee Marvin through windows, in mirrors, against glass walls. Glass is everywhere. When Marvin needs a weapon in a tight spot, he smashes a beer bottle and rubs its jagged edge against the throat of a gun-toting hood. I don't even know what all the glass imagery is supposed to represent, other than some cliché like the mirror of men's souls, but it's certainly great to look at. This is a thriller whose pretensions pay off, even 20 years later. Among other new videocassette releases, there's The Good Mother, starring Diane Keaton, in an adaptation of the Sue Miller novel. Where Miller's book inspired arguments about whether its title character really was a good mother or not, the movie, directed by Leonard Nimoy, stacks the deck in favor of a noble, persecuted mom. The movie is spineless, but Diane Keaton is strong and subtle.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, mathematician John Allen Paulos tells us about innumeracy. That's the mathematical equivalent of illiteracy. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new album from trumpeter Ahmed Abdullah, who toured Africa with bandleader Sun Ra. And television critic David Bianculli reviews Day One. It's a new made-for-TV movie that tells the story of America's race to build the atomic bomb. It stars Michael Tucker and Brian Dennehy. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Lisa Bruton, Phyllis Myers, and Amy Sallet. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Deborah Beagle. Research assistants from Christopher Cook and Ami Roosevelt. Our engineer is Thad Kirk. Chris Burgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.